time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 15 and 16. We're going to look at these, proceed a little farther in our study. 2 Samuel chapter 15 and 16. We're studying of the reign of King David as he rules over the people of God. And in the 15th chapter, we have studied how that Absalom desires to take the kingdom away from his father. A very sad chapter in many ways. We know in the first six verses what attempt does Absalom set forth to gain favor of the people in order that he might lead a rebellion against his father. He has a plan involving judgments. Hint. All right, Randy.
You would have to call me.
I would. Yes. Yes.
Go ahead. Let Carolyn.
All right, Carolyn.
I'm not sure if I understand this passage correctly. It's one of those that you have to retrieve carefully, at least in my opinion. But he's basically standing where people go to, you know, try to get a judgment, things like that. And he's, there's a word for what he's doing, but he's standing there going, oh, you came for a judgment. Well, I were giving a judgment. This is what I would do. And he's kind of turning people against the king. I don't know if I explained it exactly right. But
that's exactly right. Yes, I would do him justice, he said. And so he promotes himself. And he did that many times, it appears, to the extent that he began to gain a following. And you'll notice in verse 6, it tells us that Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now, verse 7, I want to set this forth as a reminder. It says, it came to pass at the end of 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed unto Jehovah in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode at Geshur in Syria, saying, if Jehovah shall indeed bring me again to Jerusalem, then I will serve Jehovah. Now, in this process, we find that he has a plot, as the plot thickens, that he's going to have himself declared to be king in Hebron. Now, the thing that I wanted to remind you of is in verse 7, when the text tells us it came to pass at the end of 40 years that Absalom said unto the king. We need to be reminded just here that the totality of David's reign was 40 years. A footnote in the American Standard indicates 4 years. Probably 4 years is the period of time that we're talking about, because we know that it was the desire of Absalom to take the kingdom from David, and if 40 years be the accounting, it would be difficult to bring together the math. But what we do learn is that he is declared to be king. Now, what we do want to note is that he solicits the advice, the counsel of Ahithophel. And we were talking about Ahithophel in our last study, and we noted that Ahithophel was the advisor or counselor for David. But we learned that between Ahithophel and Absalom, they create a conspiracy against his father and attempts to take the kingdom. Well, we know that the result of all of that is that David found it necessary to leave the city, the beloved city of Jerusalem that he had taken from the Jebusites, that he had named after him, and as it was called, the city of David. And we know that when he left the city of Jerusalem, the text tells us that it was his desire to take the battle somewhere else. It was not his desire that he be slain or those of his army be slain in the city. You'll see at verse 14. But then in verse 16, the king left 10 women that were concubines to keep his house. I simply want you to underscore that in your mind, because we're going to be looking at that further when we get over to the 16th chapter. Those that David left, the concubines in Jerusalem. Dropping down further in the text, David flees the city. There are those who are priests who bring the Ark of the Covenant to David outside the city? What's his desire that be done with the Ark of the Covenant? Take it back. Take it back to the city. How is David reasoning at this point? Well, David has not been the very best character either, and that's why all this has come upon him. And if you'll notice in verse 25, he said, "Carry it back, the Ark of God, to the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of Jehovah, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he say thus, I have no delight in thee, behold, here I am, let him do to me as seemeth good unto him." In other words, this rebellion by my son and this coup of my kingdom may very well be the punishment of God upon me for the things that I've done, as he was told some of these things by Samuel. Dropping down further in the text, we note that David went up by the Mount of Olives. He wept as he went, his head uncovered, or I'm sorry, his head covered and barefooted. It tells us that he went weeping as they went, and Ahithophel and the conspirators with Absalom, or were with Absalom. Notice, if you will, in verse 31, the latter part, it says, "And David said, O Jehovah, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Now, underscore that, if you will. We're going to want to remember that. Turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Well, the counsel of Ahithophel has not yet been given, but when it is given, it is indeed turned into foolishness. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But dropping down further in the text, verse 32, there's a man by the name of Hushai. Now, somebody tell me who he is. Hushai, the Archite, came to meet David. Pardon me? He's an old friend. O-L-D. He's an old friend. And it tells us that he came to David with his coat rent and earth upon his head. In verse 33, it tells us that David said unto him, "If thou passeth on with me, then thou wilt be a burden unto me." He doesn't want the responsibility of caring for this old friend. But I do want to call your attention to what he does want Hushai to do. What does he want him to become in the courts of his son Absalom? Be a spy. That's right. Go back, and if you find out anything useful, you send word to me, and then that will be good. So Hushai becomes a spy for David. Dropping down to chapter 16. Chapter 16. We read of Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth. Ziba has a plan. What does he want from David?
He wants all of Saul's stuff.
Yeah. And so we find out later that he's basically abandoned Mephibosheth. And so he comes down and questions are raised. But then in verse 5, it tells us of a man named Shimei. Shimea, pronounce that for me, Richard, if you will. Verse 6 it is.
Shimei.
Okay. Verse
5. Without the
extra H, but still.
Shimei.
That's close. Shimei. The son of Gera. All right. We're going to want to remember him too. Shimei. All right. We learn in verse 6 that he cast stones at David and all of his servants, and you'll notice that he began to curse David, saying, "Begone, begone, thou man of blood," verse 7, "and base fellow, Jehovah hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned, and Jehovah hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son, and behold, thou art taken in thine own mischief, because thou art a man of blood." Now, we've got a man named Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Abishai, he doesn't like what Shimei has to say. I know what a mother may I. Now, I won't forget that. You sound like Don with the connection of these words. What is it that, I just forgot his name, Abishai, wants to do with Shimei? Yeah, I want to kill him. I'll kill him. Well, again, look at David's reasoning. David says, "No, don't kill him. Leave him alone." Why? I may deserve this. Yeah, I may deserve this. Just leave him be. In verse 15, the text continues. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And it came to pass, when Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, was coming to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king." Why is Absalom suspicious of Hushai? He knows he's David's good friend for a long time. And how does Hushai explain now his newfound allegiance to Absalom?
He says that it's his duty to serve the king.
My duty to serve the king. If you're the king, then I'll serve you, like I served your father, who was the king. Now, in verse 20, look carefully. We learn it says, "Then said Absalom to Ahithophel, give your counsel what we shall do. And Ahithophel said unto Absalom, go in unto thy father's concubines that he hath left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that thou art abhorred of thy father. Then will the hands of all that are with thee be strong." So they spread Absalom a tent upon the top of the house, and Absalom went in unto his father's concubines in the sight of all of Israel. I want to pause just there. Two things, really three things that I want to note just here. One of the things is that this was a part of the prophecy that had been made back over in chapter 12, as David had committed sin by taking Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Nathan came to him and told him, "Here are the consequences of what you've done." And one of those consequences you'll read beginning in verse 11. Chapter 12, verse 11. What is it? Alright, you're going to have problems in your house. That's right. And he says in verse 11, "Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son." Now you remember the concubines that David left in the city to take care of things in his house. And now here comes his son, Absalom, just as was prophesied by Nathan the prophet. And they pitch a tent upon the top of the house. And Absalom goes in unto David's concubines in the sight of all of Israel. Now, what was the significance of that? Not just a fulfillment of prophecy. But we've got a custom of history involved here. When one man would conquer another king, what would he do with that king's wives? He would take them. Well, David did that, did he not? And now we see David's son, Absalom, doing that with David's concubines, as the case is here. Now, another point that I want you to see is found in verse 23. Bruce? Well, perhaps. Perhaps so. I mean, they would probably receive something. But that's
a humility.
Well, it's a sign of victory, is what it is. Absalom has taken what's David's. So these women become, in essence, the spoil, as it were. And Absalom takes it. Now in verse 23 it says, "The counsel of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if a man inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom." Now that doesn't mean that Ahithophel necessarily was a prophet. But how was his counsel perceived?
Top notch.
Top notch, yes. What Ahithophel says, that's what we do. It was as if this counsel came from God. Now keep in mind that Ahithophel's counsel, David has called upon God to turn it into foolishness. Now, what you see is the swinging of the pendulum. Ahithophel's counsel was regarded as it was the counsel of God. But later we're going to see that Ahithophel's counsel was indeed turned into foolishness in the mind of Absalom, and it cost him. And we're going to see what in just a little bit. But as you begin chapter 17, here's Ahithophel's counsel. Now remember that Absalom has asked Ahithophel, "Tell me what to do." And what is it that Ahithophel says to do? Now picture the setting. We've got Absalom in Jerusalem. We've got David and those who support him who have fled the city. And what does Ahithophel say to do?
I'm sorry, I want you to answer the question I had.
All right.
According to the law, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 11, if there's a man who lies with his father's wife, he is under her of his father's nakedness, both of them shall surely be put to death. Left guiltiness is a vomit. Was that built for concubines too?
Well, you would like to think. The whole idea of concubinage, that introduces a whole another layer to our study. Concubinage was never approved of God. The law that you're talking about that was given in Leviticus chapter 20 included, thou shalt not commit adultery, which, as far as the one man, one woman law is concerned, that was the law of Moses. But they weren't practicing what the law of Moses had taught and had not been for some time. So, the idea of concubinage was not a part of God's plan governing the marriage relationship from the beginning. And so that introduces, like I said, a whole new layer of study. And why God tolerated concubinage, why God tolerated the plurality of wives, that sort of thing. Is not according to the original plan of God. I think the only answer to that is he tolerated to get to a point in the scheme of redemption where the Christ would be made known and salvation offered through him. It never proved that a man had multiplied wives, and it's specifically condemned among the kings, Deuteronomy chapter 17. So we've got a lot of elements here that I can't explain.
I'm just trying to get a handle on Absalom taking his father's concubines. Prophecy says your companion, or that's the New American Standard says companion, like you said, neighbor.
Yeah.
But it turns out the companion is your son.
Yeah.
It just seems abhorrent.
Well, it is. And it was. Yeah.
And the broad daylight thing was a, like.
Add insult to injury.
To brag.
Yeah.
To show.
He gained victory.
Publicly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not far off from in 1 Corinthians, the sleeping with the father's wife, you know, he's pretty close to incest.
Well, yeah.
Taboo in every society.
Yeah, yeah. It's not anything that's all that new. Of course, like I said, that introduces a whole new layer to our study. But what we're looking at here with Absalom and David's concubines, and I mentioned, well, David did the same thing, did he not? When he conquered others, didn't he take their wives? Yeah. So this is not necessarily something that's new. It was a part of the culture, of the custom of the time, a sign of victory over the man that you've conquered. You take what's his, including his wives. And so this is what Absalom is doing. But nonetheless, it's not just a part of the culture. This was a part of the curse that was pronounced upon David. Your insult's going to come from within your house.
I'm going to say, as I look back at chapter 12, we realize that God said to David, you did it secretly, but it will be done to you publicly.
That's right. That's right. Everybody will know. What you did, you brought Bathsheba to your house. And now this is going to be done on the top of the roof where everybody knows. And the very fact that his servants prepared the place on the roof is evidence of the fulfillment of that.
I think the commentator here comments about Hushai's failure to do anything to overturn Ahithophel's counsel. And he comments that it may be that Hushai thought this was the best thing to do because that meant there could be no reconciliation between David and his son.
Well, that's right. And we want to go ahead and look at what Hushai advises, contrasted with Ahithophel's advice. But first, let's get Ahithophel's counsel. In verses 1 through 4, at first the saying, verse 4, pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. What was Ahithophel's advice?
Look, Ahithophel's advice was to go in and spoil everything and take everything away from the king, and then he'll go in and kill him.
Okay. Let's focus on that just a little bit more directly. He wants to take 12,000 soldiers to begin with. But the idea is, I'm going to go in and only kill the king. So we're not going to have a lot of soldiers lose their lives here. We're going to go in while David is on the run, while he's weak and weary and resting, we'll go in and we'll overthrow the camp and just kill the king. That's his desire.
But, you know, this whole thing, God has never really, you know, wanting all that to happen. God said from the very beginning, if you go in and you destroy the enemies, you destroy them all and take everything.
Oh, this is all a package deal.
Yeah.
This is all a package deal. But this directly is a consequence of what David did. Yeah. But it goes back to the conquering of the land. Yeah, they left some in the land, made peace with some who were in the land. They were not to do that. And that all is related. But the specifics of this, Ahithophel says, I want to take 12,000 men, and while David's army is weary, we'll go and take them in their encampment, and I'll kill only David, and I'll bring everybody else back. His indication is I'm going to reunite the kingdom under the leadership of Absalom. And we'll recognize his kingship. Well, verse 4 tells us that saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Now you can see on the surface how that Ahithophel's advice might very well be good. It might unite the kingdom under the leadership of Absalom. But Hushai, the Archite, he comes in before Absalom. And Absalom says, well, what do you think, Mr. Hushai? And Hushai says, well, that's a foolish idea. That's a bad idea. That is not good, is the expression used in verse 7. He said, moreover, thou knowest thy father and his men, this is verse 8, that they are mighty men, and they are chafed in their minds, and bear as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And thy father is a man of war and will not lodge with the people. Behold, he is hid now in some pit or in some other place. And it will come to pass when some of them are fallen at the first that whosoever heareth it will say, there is a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. And even he that is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, will utterly melt. For all Israel knoweth that thy father is a mighty man, and they that are with him are valiant men. Now, what's his counsel? He said, what I want you to do is to gather everybody up that you can find, not just 12,000 men. But you go all the way from Dan to Beersheba. Now, here's an element that's cast into the equation by Hushai that is not in the equation with the advice of Ahithophel. What is it? Time. Time. You see, Ahithophel's argument is, let's act promptly. David's on the run. He's down there camped somewhere. We'll find him. We'll take 12,000 men. We'll bring everybody back. We'll kill only David. But Hushai's argument is, you gather everybody you can find from Dan to Beersheba. Now, you know where Dan is? Way up the top. Where's Beersheba? Way down here at the bottom. All right? You gather everybody up, and we'll put together a great big army. And we'll go in, and we'll fight all of them, and we will kill all of them and deliver the kingdom into your hand. Now, you know your father's not going to surrender. You know he's not going to be encamped with the men. He's king. So this is the only way that this is going to work. Now look, if you will, at verse 13. He said, moreover, if he be begotten into a city, then shall all Israel bring ropes to that city and we'll draw it into the river until there be not one small stone found there. We'll destroy everything. Now Hushai sounds like a real meanie, don't he? But what's he recognized that his plan has that Ahithophel doesn't? Time. Time. Why is that so important? Well, it gives time to warn David. Now look, if you will, at verse 15. Wasn't that Hushai's job? He's a spy.
It also puts Absalom in the battle.
It does. Yes, very good. It does. It puts him in the battle. It does indeed. Now, beginning at verse 15, it says, "And Hushai said to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now, therefore, send quickly and tell David, saying, lodge not this night at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him." In other words, what's he telling him to do? Don't stop. Get out of Dodge. Run. Keep going. Now, you remember we had a map up last time where we showed the travels of David from Jerusalem as he came down through over the Mount of Olives, I should say, and down to the Jordan River. And then we showed it crossing the Jordan River and coming up on the other side to the city of, I always say Mahanaim, but that's not correct. It's Mahanaim. Mahanaim. Is that pretty close?
No.
No! That's how the man on the tape said it. Oh, okay. Well, that's how he pronounced it. Anyway, beside the point. Mahanaim is acceptable in English?
Yeah, except for the long A at the beginning.
Oh, Mahanaim. That's where David went. And when the battle ensues, it ensues around this place, you see. And what happens? Well, you know the outcome of the battle, do you not? Look, if you will, at verse 6. Verse 6. Chapter 18. Verse 6. It says, "So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were smitten there before the servant of David. And there was a great slaughter there that day of 20,000 men." Now, do you suppose this is how Absalom anticipated things would go? What do you suppose for a moment that this is how Ahithophel had planned it? You'll need to think about that, because we're going to see a reason to back up and look at that. Back up, if you will, at verse 23 of chapter 17. In verse 23 of chapter 17, it says, "And when the Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home unto his city, and set his house in order and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father." Now, why would he do that? Does he know what's going to be? Well, think what would happen if Absalom came back. He going to be listening to Ahithophel? Well, think what happens if David comes back. Is he going to be listening to Ahithophel? Things don't look too good for Ahithophel, do they? So he went out and hanged himself. Now, we know that 20,000 are slain in verse 6 and 7 of chapter 18. There are three captains of David's army. We generally think of Joab as perhaps chief among the captains. He's one of the leaders. Abishai is another in verse 2. And Ittai, a third in the latter part of verse 2. What admonitions or admonition does David give to the captains of his men when this battle is about to occur? John? Pardon me? I wanted to know what admonition did David give to the captains of his army about Absalom? Anyone? Take care of Absalom. That's in chapter 18, verse 5. "The king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even Absalom. And all the people heard when the kings gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom." Now, when things get to be in a mess of the battle and 20,000 men are being killed, what happens to Absalom?
It's caught in a tree.
Notice that this battle is taking place in the forest of Ephraim, and he's dragging along on his mule, and what happens to all that hair? He got caught in a tree limb and yanked him right off his mule, and there he hung.
Verse 8 is a curious verse. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured.
Well, that impressed me too, considering where the battle is fought. Forest of Ephraim. Now, I didn't go, you can do this, do a Google Earth and just zoom right in on this, but from what I understand, this area on the eastern side of the Jordan River, the Eastern Plateau, or Trans-Jordan Plateau, as we sometimes think of it, around this area is very rugged. And this is where the battle is taking place. And my understanding of this text is that there were some who were consumed by the forest. If you're fighting in bitter elements, as it were, such as these were, then in the fury of all the battle, there's going to be things, bad things happen. You might fall off your mule, roll down a hill, fall in a hole, drop through a cave, who knows what. Pardon me?
You would think that would be key for us on both sides.
Well, you might think so. But what we want to note here is this whole thing is kind of being governed by the providence of God. So the battle goes south for Absalom and his soldiers.
It's kind of what I was thinking too. When John just said, chapter 17, verse 14. Absalom and all men of Israel said to the council of Uzziah that Archite is better than the council of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good council of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom.
Yep.
Well,
this was in
God had his hand in this.
Wasn't that what David asked?
And the forest consumed more than the slaughter.
Yep.
With the sword.
Yeah, and that's exactly what David asked God to do. Bring the counsel, verse 31 of chapter 15, the counsel of Ahithophel, bring it to foolishness. And it was. It was brought to foolishness. So here we go. Bruce?
Well, even if Ahithophel would have went in and had done whatever he said with 12,000, you hear in chapter 18, there would have been no way that he would have even won the battle.
Well, keep in mind, though, that what Ahithophel is advising is a different battlefield.
Yeah.
Completely a different battlefield. So, we could speculate, but that's all it would be. You know, what would it have been if Ahithophel's plan had been followed? I don't know. But it wasn't followed. And so here's the way that it played out. And as you read in verse 14 to chapter 17, that was the plan of God. The providence of God is involved in this. So we've got 20,000 men that died that day. It was horrible. And when you see Absalom hanging there in the tree, this is the king, the proposed king. Not very kingly state to be hanging from an oak tree, is it, by the hair of your head. And you move, your mule run out from under you. Makes you wonder, where did the rest of your compadres go? You don't have a lot of help, evidently. So, at any rate, reading beginning in verse 9, it said, "And Absalom chanced to meet the servants of David, and Absalom was riding upon his mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak and was taken up between heaven and earth, and the mule that was under him went on, and a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, 'Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak.' And Joab said unto the man that told him, 'And behold, thou sawest it, and why didst not thou smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 pieces of silver and a girdle.' And the man said to Joab, 'Though I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put forth my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Hittai, saying, Beware that none touch the young man Absalom.'" Now, this man, though he's unidentified, that saw this, points out to Joab that I would have been in trouble with you, too, if I had killed him. So, he wouldn't do that. But what did Joab do?
Killed him.
Well, it tells us that he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak, and 10 young men that bare Joab's armor compassed him about and smote Absalom and slew him. So these Absalom's dead. Between 3 darts and 10 men, Absalom is dead. Now, there's an interesting query that follows in all of this. It tells us that Joab blew the trumpet and the people returned from pursuing after Israel. The war is over. The war is over. David has won. His army have become victors, and it's all over. So they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a great heap of stones. I find the contrast of these verses quite fascinating. Absalom dead in the pit, and they pile rocks on him. And then in verse 18, it tells us that Absalom in his lifetime had taken and reared up for himself the pillar which is in the king's dale, for he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance," and he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument unto this day. So Absalom erected a pillar of stones and called it a monument to celebrate himself, and Joab and the people, they raised up a little bit different kind of monument for young Absalom. Being dead at the bottom of the pit, they covered him with rocks. Okay? Any question or comment just here? All right. We then learn of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. He wants to run and tell the king, bring these tidings to the king. I'm perplexed why. Maybe some of you could enlighten me on that. Why does he want to have this privilege of telling the king? And then, of course, you know that Joab tells him that, no, you're not going to be bidding the king the news of the death of his son. And he selects Cushai, or the Cushite, to go and tell the king. And then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, asks again Joab that he might go and tell the king, and he is allowed to run, and the text tells us that he outran the Cushite, so he got there first. But what does he tell the king when he gets there? When the king inquires about Absalom, any news about Absalom, what does Ahimaaz say to David about his son? Pardon? I don't know. What about your son? All I know is that the battle was thick and there was something going on down there, and I can't tell you any more than that. He says, "You stand here. There's another runner coming. The Cushite is coming." And look at what the Cushite has to say, the one that was sent out first. And he asked in verse 32, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "The enemies of my lord, the king, and all that rise up against thee to do thee harm or do thee hurt, be as that young man is." Well, pause right there. The Cushite's got the answer. Absalom's dead. Why didn't Ahimaaz tell him that? Well, I mean, he has asked permission to be the one to go, and he was told no, and then he asked again, and he's given permission to go, and then when he gets there, he doesn't tell the bad news.
I don't know for a fact. I just speculate, but it could be that he remembers what happened to the guy that gave it to him, how Saul died.
All right. Could be. I don't know either. I'm just asking out of curiosity. I find it interesting that he's asked permission to go, and then when he insists on getting permission to go a second time, then when he gets there, he doesn't tell him about Absalom. It's just a curiosity. I've read some speculative remarks that just that. I mean, they're speculation. But it's still a curiosity.
It seems like that's been happening.
Pardon me?
It seems like that's been happening for quite a while.
What, when David gets bad news, he kills the fellow that brings him the bad news?
That's the person who saw something get kill him, you don't tell him, then they wind up dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe that's why he doesn't say anything about it. I just find it curious that he wanted to go so bad, and then when he gets there, he doesn't have anything to say.
Back in chapter 15, the last couple of verses, is this the same Ahimaaz? And can you connect the dots? I'm losing track of people. What's Ahimaaz's relationship to this whole thing? He's the son of Zadok, and he's been with when Hushai went, when we've seen him before, is there some connection that way to what we want to?
I'm not certain. There is a relationship here somewhere, and of course, Ahimaaz is evidently a noted runner. Because of the way that he runs, it's observed that this must be Ahimaaz or Ahimaaz because he runs that way, runs like this man. So, you've heard the expression, so-and-so sure knows how to sit a horse. They can tell him from some distance about who's riding the horse.
I know that expression from my
Oh, okay. Well, well, something about the way this man ran, they knew who he was. But what the relationship that he had with David, he was the son of Zadok, and Zadok was one of the priests. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, that's the end of 15.
Yes, Zadok and Abiathar, the priest. So evidently he is someone that David knows and knows rather well. Beyond that, I don't know.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Hushai was to tell Zadok or Abiathar, and then they were to send.
They were to send Ahimaaz and Jonathan.
And Jonathan. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's right.
So maybe they had this previous relationship from having shared meat before or something like that?
Perhaps so.
Yeah, maybe I'll. Yeah.
Perhaps they had communicated news to Saul. I mean, all that speculation, I don't know. I just don't know. It's interesting.
In 31, the Cushite kind of puts a positive spin on it and says, there's good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you. We didn't really mention Absalom yet.
Not yet. No.
I thought that was interesting.
No, not yet. Yeah. Do you have your hand up?
Well, I was going to say, there is one other Ahimaaz, and that's in 1 Samuel 14. But that Ahimaaz is the father of one of Saul's wives. So this Ahimaaz is a different one.
Yeah, I was thinking that far back in on the timeline would make that man probably too old to be a runner.
Right. So then, no other Ahimaaz is mentioned again until 2 Samuel 15:27.
Okay. Well, then we just don't have an abundance of information on this particular man. But to get to the point, the Cushite bears the news that Absalom is dead. And notice verse 33 now. It says, "And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. As he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Would I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." When you read those words, don't it just wrench your heart? Because the thing that's happened here didn't have to happen. This is consequence of sin that David has committed. And no doubt, when we see consequences of our own sin expended upon somebody else, we might like to satisfy ourselves that if I could have corralled all the consequences and borne them myself, then that would have been better and certainly more to my desire. But that's not the case. Would God I had died for thee. David had rather anything happen than for such awful things to happen in his own family. I can't begin to express the grief that David must feel for all the horrible things that have come within his own house. Yes.
Do you believe his sins? Or is this just kind of a greedy son that was like, I want to be king now? And I can't say for sure that I feel that this is all bearing down on him because of his sins. It was just like what happened, I guess.
Well, when we go back to Nathan's speech to David in chapter 12, pick up the reading there beginning about verse 9, 2 Samuel 12. It says, "Wherefore hast thou despised the word of Jehovah to do that which is evil in his sight? Thou hast smitten Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and hast taken his wife to be thy wife, and hast slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thy house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them into thy neighbor, or unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. For thou doest it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." Now, the evil, Nathan says, is going to come from your own house. Now, he doesn't specify that Absalom's going to try to take the kingdom away. But you're going to have trouble inside your house. Now, what's that consist of? We see that play out with Amnon taking Tamar, his half-sister, and committing or raped her. And then we see Absalom killing Amnon. And then we see Absalom trying to take the kingdom from his father. I mean, all of this within David's immediate family. And Nathan said that the trouble is going to be from your house because of what you did. So it really didn't have to be that way. Randy, and then Richard.
Yes, it's true, Absalom was selfish. There was David obviously loved his son more than his son loved him. Absalom wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
So he could be king.
Yeah.
So it's definitely an unequal
fault
between them.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say that in his, we're going to call it later life, but here in this time of David's life, he shows himself to be a very weak person. Everything that's happened to him has happened because he's failed to do what it was his responsibility to do in each case.
Okay.
He shouldn't have taken Bathsheba. He shouldn't have gotten mad at Absalom because he killed Amnon. And even if he didn't get mad at him, he didn't call Absalom back the way he should have and said, told him that you've done the right thing, but rather let Absalom think that the king was angry with him. Then when Absalom takes the kingdom here, now he goes up in the tower and weeps for the man that should have been killed.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that nearly cost him the loyalty of the people who fought for him.
Right.
So David's messed up in this thing a lot. But I want to go back to one point, just momentarily. When you say that, couldn't we have just a selfish young man? Well, I know that from what Nathan said, these consequences are imposed as a result of bad decisions that David has made. But it doesn't nullify the responsibility of Absalom for what he's done here. Yes, Absalom is a selfish young man. It's his desire to take the kingdom from his father. But what I want us to see in all of this is how God can use the evil part of someone like Absalom in his providence to chastise someone like David, whom we learn is a man after God's own heart. But he needed to be chastised what he did wrong. And we see a contrast of hearts, especially when we look at Psalms 52 or 51, is it, where David said, "My sin is ever before me," and a host of passages, Psalms 32 and others, written what most scholars believe during this troublesome time in David's life, indicating that he is just torn up and anguished in heart because of this whole ball of wax that's going on in his life. But yes, Absalom's responsible for what he did. Bruce?
That he didn't do all time something happens, he procrastinates. We just disapprove of all.
Well, during this troublesome period, that's true.
Yeah.
I think ultimately we do see some changes in David. I think the Psalms bear that out significantly. We'll talk more about that Sunday. Okay. Yes.
Yes, I think he realized that his sins were before him, and he knew what, you know, he knew what he was going through. So, and when that's what he had to say, we just deal with his problem.
That's right. I did.
What was going on?
I did.
So I got to deal with it.
Okay. Good point.
In other words, saying like what goes around it comes around.
It has.
Yeah.
Notice it's taken years for that to happen too.
Yeah.